Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're with RCR Greenwashed with Jaspreet and Don. And over the years, we've talked about many issues. But recently, we talked to Brian Leyland, you might recall, about the electricity sector. And he put us in touch with another guy, Rod Fulford, who is a structural engineer. And he was wanting us to talk about how our earthquake standards are being applied in New Zealand. Secondly, we thought, well, let's get Rod on, and we have him here today, but we'll get John Scarry back as well. Now, John's been a regular contributor on RCR, perhaps till the later part of last year. And both these gentlemen are structural engineers. But why did we think we need to have them on? Well, in Invercargill, we've actually got a new museum being promoted. It's a significant chunk of cash for the Invercargill ratepayers. And of course, we've been not allowed in that building since 2015 because we were told it was earthquake prone and dangerous. Jaspreet, you're a councillor and you've got your part of your building is not allowed to be used, or your main headquarters of a few years ago, you don't use that for your main executive.
So that was before my time, but Southland District Council vacated its offices, its old offices.
And so, look, there's a lot of confusion. We've had the Christchurch earthquakes, we've had the Kaikoura earthquakes, we've had Wellington earthquakes. We've had a whole lot of things go on in the last 15 years, and I've listened to a lot of property owners saying, oh, they can't meet standards, so they might as well just close the building down and not let it out. And of course, now there is a lot of derelict buildings in rural New Zealand and regional New Zealand because they've been told effectively that they don't meet the standards. So look, let's shed some light on this. And so, as I said, today we have two structural engineers, Rod Fulford, John Scarry, and we're going to try and open the can of worms, it seems. So welcome, gentlemen. Who wants to go first? Who's right? Who's wrong? Who's telling porkies? Who's entering my checkbook uninvited? Aside from the council, who wants to go first? John, you've got some views about 2004 Building Act versus today.
Yes, I'm here not to defend the earthquake-prone building process or attack it. I just want to put it into perspective and clarify some of the things, because there's an awful lot, particularly recently, of simply wrong statements about it all. We are not talking about current code standards or bringing buildings up to current code standards or whatever. The purpose of the earthquake-prone building concept, which was actually enacted fully in 2004, not 2016, but unfortunately this is New Zealand, so everyone sits on their backside for 15, 20 years and does nothing. But it was actually here fully in the Building Act of 2004. And the purpose of it was to weed out the worst buildings which could collapse in a moderate earthquake. Now, I sent you a diagram which shows the zone factors of New Zealand, and that's based on estimates of the seismicity. So the forces we design buildings for varies greatly between where you are in the country. For the same type of soil and for the same frequency of vibration of a building, the loading is proportional to what's called the Z factor. So in Wellington, you're designing for a Z factor of 0.4. In Auckland, it's 0.13. In Arthur's Pass, it's 0.6. In Christchurch, it's now 0.3. In Invercargill, it's 0.17. And Dunedin, it's 0.13. And down in Fiordland, it's 0.6. So it's largely aligned with the main plate line through New Zealand. But it's not like, for example, the earthquake loading in Invercargill has been assessed on the basis of being in Wellington or Christchurch or anything. In fact, Invercargill has a very low zone factor for New Zealand. And The threshold that's set for the assessment of an earthquake-prone building is that its ultimate strength has to be able to resist one-third of current code loading. So if you were to work out in Invercargill, a new building had to be designed for, say, a lateral force of 900 kilonewtons distributed up the height of the building, the earthquake-prone building assessment is only done considering a third of that, which is 300 kilonewtons. And also, the methodology that's allowed to apply is very, very liberal. It is not conservative. You can use higher material strength than you would for a new building. You can not apply capacity reduction factors, and you can rely on all sorts of geometries and mechanisms of response that are actually so unreliable, they're banned, they're designed out of new buildings. So it is a low threshold.
So you are saying, John, this is very subjective as to how a building is assessed?
No, what I'm saying is that the earthquake-prone building check is against one-third of current code loading. It's not
34%.
About... And so if it's if the strength, and what I'm saying is that you're allowed to take an approach that we is more liberal and we couldn't apply to a new building. So it's not as if everything is stacked against the existing building. Everything is stacked in the favour of the existing building, including the fact that you can work out its strength on the basis that it's not really damaged, but you can further reduce the loading on the basis that it's damaged and has high damping. So it is really not a high standard to me.
Right.
And legally, if it is at 30, if your strength is at 34% of this loading, then you don't have to do anything. Now, a tenant may come in and demand a higher level of resistance, but legally, if you hit the 34%, then there's nothing anyone else can make you do about it. And there have been problems in the past of getting wildly different earthquake-prone building assessments. And the problem with that, of course, is you're dealing with arrangements of materials and materials and arrangements of buildings that are often so bad we don't even use them. We're not allowed to use them today. So you've got engineers used to designing a good modern building trying to figure out how this appallingly arranged poor material is going to perform. So the only difference between 2016 and 2004 is that finally a set of consistent documents were developed to assess the strength of a building to try and give more consistent approach. That is the only thing that really came in 2016-17, where these documents were locked into legislation to be the methodology for determining earthquake-prone building status and how you would strengthen them. We've learned more things since then. But basically, all of this came about in 2004. And someone I was associated with at work contacted me in his private initiative. And he said, my friend and I want to buy a pub. I think it was near Thames. It's a brick building. And previously, in the early 20th century, it had been timber and it burnt down. So they'd rebuilt it in unreinforced brickwork. And I said to him, well, this new legislation in 2004 creates a great deal of uncertainty. You've got to be careful. And I presume he didn't buy it. Stupid me. I should have said, this is New Zealand. We'll mess around and do nothing for 25 years and you can buy it and make a fortune. But the thing that annoys me at the moment is getting councils to the new minister saying, oh, we don't have enough time. We don't have enough time. Well, they've had since 2004. And people have been buying buildings since 2004 without consideration of the earthquake-prone status. And even in recent years, they've been doing it. Even in Wellington, where have they been?
Right. Well, where have they been? Now, Rod, we need to give you the opportunity to come in here and give your penny's worth. How do you view everything John said to this point?
Well, what John says is absolutely correct, but we've got to deal with a real situation here. We have got hundreds and thousands of buildings that really we can't afford to raise up to the standard that is required. Particularly older communities, such as you mentioned Invercargill, has a high percentage of buildings that are considered earthquake prone and need to be upgraded. I think that's basically because Invercargill is an older established community, and so it has a higher proportion of old masonry buildings, which were the standard in the days. They were considered the top, great buildings. So now we have to decide how we should deal with it. And the reality to me is that you can never have a building that is 100% safe against any sort of earthquake, because earthquakes are unpredictable. We talk about a certain magnitude. It's not just the magnitude, it's the proximity. If an earthquake happens right under that building, it is going to be damaged. So then we're getting on to expectations. People expect buildings to survive earthquakes, but the legislation, what the engineers are trying to do, is predominantly around life safety, that the building may be damaged, but what we want to do is prevent it collapsing and killing a lot of people in the process. So people may think that they've got an earthquake-proof building, or the building has been upgraded or strengthened, so it's going to be great. An earthquake will come along and it will damage the building and people will be disappointed. But then that's not the objective of our legislation and not what engineers are trying to do. We accept that buildings may be damaged in an earthquake, but what we're trying to do is prevent total collapse and loss of life from that. What's the best way of going about it at the moment? In reality, we don't have the resources in the country, the financial resources, to bring every building up to the required standard. So what's the best use of the resources and the money in terms of lives saved for the amount of money we're spending? And how much good are we really doing by taking so many buildings out of service? There's certainly going to be a lot of buildings, for instance, masonry buildings in churches around the country. No one is going to have the money to replace those or bring them up to standard. Mm. There's going to be so many old post offices and old government buildings that have been repurposed into restaurants and things. No one's going to have the money to bring those up to standard. But how far should we go? It really, to me, is a matter of managing public expectations, getting the best bang for your buck, and accepting everything as a bit of a compromise. I'd love every building to be up to the highest standard, just as I would love everyone driving a car to be driving the safest possible car. But not everyone is going to buy the top-end Mercedes. They're going to compromise and accept that compromise.
Yeah.
We've got to do a bit of the same approach for the buildings, I think. Anyway, that's my little rant.
Oh, it's fantastic. So the way I understand the world of engineering is you can engineer just about anything you want to a standard you want, and you can just about beat any condition that may be thrown at it, barring the extreme events. And engineers are good at, why would we have, for instance, 100-story plus buildings if it wasn't for great engineers doing stuff? I mean, we can't have, clearly the demand for land in built up metropolitan areas is high. We're not going to have a metropolitan area all with single story buildings. So we trust engineers to do everything right.
What engineers will do, and you can trust them to do, is to design to the forces that they are knowingly designing to. Mm-hmm. And we have New Zealand standards, and every country has their standards. Design for these situations, these conditions, which develop these forces against the building. Now, that's not to say that the building may never be subject to greater forces than that. The engineers just say, right, this is what we'll design to. And a commonly accepted measure is, you know, a 1 in 500 year return earthquake. What are you going to expect to occur once in 500 years? Now, people will accept that that's a remote possibility, and I'm prepared to take that chance until, bang, it happens, and it's happened right then, and then you're not happy with having taken that risk. So engineers are only capable of designing to known to the defined criteria that they're asked to design to.
Right.
How do you view, what do you say to that, John? Are you you concur that that's how you work? I mean, I'm sure you do, but just make sure.
For a very short time, I will delve into the modern design of new buildings. But I want to get back and reemphasize we're talking about earthquake-prone buildings, which is a very low bar. Now, if you design a new building properly, and if it's importance level two, you're designing for a 1 in 500 year earthquake. But because of the way you have to use the lowest 5th percentile strength and apply capacity reduction factors, it is expected that there will still be a very low probability of failure if the building is hit with a 1 in 2,500 year earthquake, because it's not a linear progression. You know, it doesn't increase by 5 times if it's a 1 in 2,500 year. And the other thing is, for modern buildings, we do design for them to be undamaged at the serviceability limit state. We deal with strength. Well, we prevent collapse, but more for the 1 in 500 year earthquake. And then we try to prevent collapse at the 1 in 2,500 year earthquake. But one of the problems we have with these existing buildings and strengthening them is that, the key thing about structural engineering and how you have to get it right and why we need bigger fees and everything like that is that, unlike software, you'd remember back in the old days of Windows coming out, you know, nowadays your computer software is updating all the time. But it used to be Windows 95 would come out, and then 6 months later, a service pack would come out, which was a complete reinstall, but they didn't tell you. Well, you can't reinstall a building. And one of the problems you've got with strengthening, say, an old brick building, there are lots of things you can do. And I agree with Rod when he talks about sort of putting posts under an awning to stop it falling down, but then they get hit by buses. You can tie the floors together, but that is stock standard earthquake prone strengthening. But if you walk around Te Aro, for example, in Wellington, you can see lots of steel bracing plonked on the side of buildings, existing concrete buildings. Now, I'm not saying all of them are like that, but certainly some of them are, and I'm not just the only one who has observed this. The strengthening is highly suspicious, because we had a lecture at university in 1980 from a Ministry of Works engineer about strengthening old buildings. And the fundamental thing he said is the strengthening has to be as stiff as or stiffer than the building. So if you've got an old concrete wall or brick wall in plane, which could fail, the only way you can really strengthen it is to put another concrete wall inside and tie it to it. Because if you put some steel straps or bracing on it, the steel is so much more flexible. It can only pick up the load when the bricks have deflected so far. And that's one of the reasons why on some of these buildings, you get to the point where tying the floors in isn't going to do it. And so to try and put in that system that's as stiff or stiffer than the existing, that's why the costs increase substantially.
Wow. Jaspreet, you go.
I was looking at the fact that, and I'm going to speak it from a completely layperson's language. For the average person, the news that comes out is often like this one that came in March this year. Tighter seismic risk standards bump up building costs. And they said that the government is consulting on a higher standard for seismic design with the aim it eventually becomes mandatory. And the National Seismic Hazard Model was updated 18 months ago. For a single council, for one single water treatment plant, the cost increased $5 million. That was for a water treatment plant around Wellington. All of this eventually has to come from somewhere. Now, in comparison to other countries who possibly face the same risk? Because, John, when you began, you reeled off a series of numbers, you know, Z, the loading factor, and that I'm presuming is seismic risk. So how do we compare apples with apples, and how do we fare, say, with other earthquake-prone countries around the Pacific Ring of Fire? Are our standards remarkably different? Are we in line with it? Because these costs need to be justified to the ordinary Joe blog on the street.
Well, the ordinary Joe blogger on the street is actually paying for all this one way or another, if it's just the people think, well, it's a building owner. You know, they're wealthy, et cetera, and it's not going to affect me. But in fact, the building owner has to recover it in rents, and the person paying the extra rent to justify the earth, all the strengthening, is passing that on in costs down the line. So the costs of it are shared by all of our society one way or another. So we've really got to think about how much is our society prepared to spend. And yeah, it is.
Where do we draw the line?
And it is a compromise. And I'll tell you what, there are some, certainly nations around the Pacific Ring of Fire, where the earthquake standards are way below what we have. And, yeah, occasionally there's an earthquake and people die, but they just can't, they don't have the resources to build to our standards. They've just got to accept that.
But now, well, again, I'll just throw in this instance here. The government is also, the last government said, bring all the roads down to, you know, certain streets down to 30 kilometers per hour. The new government said, no, we are not doing this. You know, there's a cost-benefit analysis. And, you know, if you were going to save every single life, gentlemen, we wouldn't have Kiwis hopping across the ditch to go to Australia for, say, breast cancer treatments and others. They should all have been funded here. So we obviously decide that there is a point after which anything beyond that we can't afford. So where is that line here?
Well, that's a matter of society somewhere drawing the line and agreeing on it. I mean, if you're determined to save lives, you'll put a blanket 30-kilometer speed limit everywhere around the country. Yeah, and that would definitely save lives. But yeah, we're not prepared to accept that. So it's similar to some extent with earthquake-prone buildings. Not that I expect too many people to agree with me there. John will will come up with a comment on that, I'm sure.
Well, right, if John, I was in control, I could get the death toll down on the roads close to zero, but that's not what we're here to talk about. Without spending any extra money, just breaks. Normally it's the guests that go off course, but you've gone back to new building design, and that's fine. Yeah. The thing is that at present, if you're designing in Wellington, you're sort of designing similar to Japan and Los Angeles. But if you were designing in Peru, you have to design for about 40% higher forces, et cetera. Now, you raise a good point with this national seismic hazard, whether I haven't studied it because I think it's so stupid and there's important things to do otherwise. But effectively, they seem to be doubling this earthquake loading that you have to design for, which I think in light of Christchurch is completely and utterly unjustifiable. I think the performance of buildings in Christchurch, when you back analyze them and look at it, if they were well-designed modern buildings or timber-framed houses, they took a massive pounding. Now, one thing that needs to be done in Christchurch is they need to sort of double the design loading in the hills, which hasn't been done because there's no research money, so no one pushes for it. But in the hills in Christchurch, the accelerations were about twice what they were on the ground. But if you look at the performance, if they double the design loads in Wellington, then you're basically going to have to build a solid concrete wall building that has no doors and windows to resist the forces. And it's just nonsense. The critical thing is to design buildings well for this current for the current loading. And Wellington has some really bad problems. Again, in Te Aro, there's areas of what are called loose category E soils, and they can really turn to custard in a big earthquake. Ironically, in small earthquakes, they sort of base isolate the stiff, unreinforced buildings because they're a different frequency and they can't interact. But when you look at the very poor performance of the of Stats House and the BNZ Harbour Quays and some other buildings in Wellington, it wasn't because they were designed for too small forces. They were just appallingly designed. And one of the shockers we, and it's not, and when we're going to sort of even talking about earthquake-prone buildings, it's not just about life safety in a small earthquake. We have the situation now, up until 2012 or 14 or so, there were two stages for earthquake-prone assessment. One was a spreadsheet-type approach called an ISA, an initial seismic assessment. We just plugged in the age of the building, the type of construction, and it came up with an answer. And then you would do a detailed seismic assessment. And what that ISA said was, it's designed and built after 1976. Very good. No problems. Well, as a whole class of buildings, particularly in Wellington, called ductile moment frame buildings with precast floors, which through the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s were proclaimed to lead the world in seismic engineering, they are now considered extreme seismic hazards. And although, according to the C5 concrete assessment book that was locked in legislation in 2017, they're probably not earthquake-prone building, when you assess them to the latest information, they are earthquake-prone buildings. And so do you want multi-story buildings collapsing all over the place in Wellington in a moderate earthquake? And even without collapse, there's the issue of the economic hazard. Since 1983, there's been a standard for the restraint of building services in commercial buildings, etc. These are the air conditioning ducts, the sprinklers, suspended ceilings, etc. And unfortunately, a man called Terry Johnson, who'd worked as a contractor installing building services for many years, and he says he knows where all the bodies are buried, he became really concerned because he basically said, in modern commercial buildings, very often the restraint of building services is in the performance specification. It's in the design by the subcontractors. It's in the producer statements of design, peer review, construction, and construction review. The only problem is they're not in the building. And the reason they're not in the building, despite engineers signing it all off, is even if one subcontractor puts them in, someone else cuts them out to fit their own services in. And so you had the situation with the Cook Strait earthquakes in 2013. The BNZ Harbour Quays was taken out of operation for 6 months because the building services failed, the sprinklers broke, flooded the offices, the ceilings came down, the services came down because they didn't have seismic restraint. So Terry forced MIMBY to do an investigation in Wellington, and I haven't seen the report, but he told me. The finding of it was, if a big earthquake hit Wellington and not one big building collapsed, there would be economic devastation in the CBD in Wellington from the failure of building services. And businesses would vacate these buildings for 6 months and probably never come back. So it is an enormous issue and task. But I don't think for new buildings, the cost of seismic design is unaffordable. The big problems we have are massively expensive materials. We have low efficiency, poor design, and not designing for constructability. And as far as these earthquake-prone buildings go, I would comment again that, A, these buildings were often built for £1,000 or £2,000 in 1900. What have they been traded for and sold in the intervening 125 years? How much of their value has been written off against taxes through depreciation again and again and again? And as Winston Peters said about the insurance companies after the Christchurch earthquake, where have all the premiums gone? Well, I'm asking, where has all the depreciation gone? Why isn't it there to strengthen the buildings?
A very good question.
That you're a tough taskmaster. Yeah, you'd have it that the property owners were just creaming it all those years, John. But I get your sentiment. Absolutely get your sentiment on that. So, Rod, how do you view, have you come across the sort of stuff that John has just talked about? Is that in your purview?
Well, certainly I have seen issues with building services and issues with building construction where we've put in pre-stressed concrete floor systems, for instance, which are frowned on a bit these days, but then plumbers have come along and just drilled straight through them, cutting through the critical pre-stressing.
Yeah.
And they don't fall down immediately, so no one worries too much about it. I must admit I got called into a number of buildings for comment on damage that had been done by plumbers and other service people drilling through places that they should not have. But not only that, as John brought up, the restraint of services, leaves a lot to be desired. But I think the public is generally concerned about the safety of buildings, whereas John's bringing up the economic cost of damage to services, which is another issue for sure.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. The public is, perhaps we're ill-informed and we expect to, well, we want to be safe when we go into our built-up areas. Doesn't matter whether it's in a car or whether we're entering a building, we want to be safe. But it is about how do you, and I think this is the message I'm getting from you, Rod, is what is the, how do you pay for that public expectation? Is it just beyond common sense, the expectation that society believes they should have everything gold-plated, but just can't have that?
Okay, society wants to be safe. You want to be safe when you get in a car, but realistically, statistically, a number of people are going to die. But no one ever gets into a car to drive it thinking that they're going to die. No one ever goes into the city, into a modern building, thinking they're going to die with collapse. But the reality is some people will at some stage. And how much are we prepared to spend to prevent people dying in cars or in buildings? We've got to come up with some realistic sort of compromise. Where are our resources best put?
You're talking about statistical probability, really, aren't you? You're trying to define what that is. Yeah.
Yes, it is a matter of statistical probability. We're all accepting risk in our lives. Lives are full of risks. And how far do we go on trying to get to very minimal risk with buildings and earthquakes? I'm all for safe buildings, that's for sure. And there are a number of steps that can be taken to remove the worst risks in the unreinforced masonry buildings, which are the real danger. But how far should we go? And that's a conversation that we need to have. And I think the public needs to be aware that there is a compromise and there is no such thing as guaranteed safety. Buildings are going to be damaged. John brought up one of the issues before, is that really we're talking about the serviceability levels as well as I've been talking about the probability of structural collapse and the demolition of the building and people being killed from that. But there's also the expectation that the building will not sustain anything more than some perhaps superficial minor cracks in a moderate earthquake. That's the current building standards and that's what's being designed. But of course, when you're upgrading the existing building, I don't think you can quite get there.
John, you had mentioned that, I went into new buildings and I did go into them because when people are told that a certain building is beyond repair, you can't do anything, there's no more strengthening that can be done. And out here, we have a high number in Southland and that's where people look at. But at the same time, you also said that the new National Seismic Hazard Model was so stupid that you didn't even look at it. Now, I know you've said you haven't looked at it, but do you care to qualify that stupid? What is so wrong about it, in your opinion? Because there's an inquiry underway, and I would assume that they are looking at that along with it.
Well, sorry, we're talking about something that is in draft form but hasn't been put in as the light. Basically, if you've designed a good building for low ductility but good confinement, I believe it will withstand bigger loading than current code level. And when I look at the way so many buildings that are good in Christchurch performed and back analyze and duration and all these sorts of things, and you know, I have campaigned on many aspects of problems and building and construction that need to be sorted out, the level of seismic loading has not been one of them. Because the problems I see is when you've got, like, there's a modern high-rise building in Auckland, and it was subject to investigations and so on. And because of diaphragm deficiencies, it was rated close to 0% NBS. It didn't have proper load paths in the floors to get the load to the shear walls. That is the critical thing. If the best engineers I know on good land in Wellington was to design an earthquake for the current earthquake levels, I believe I would be, I wouldn't like the shaking, but I would want to be in that building even if it was hit with a bigger load. And again, all of this has to tie, I mean, it's just so obvious again, the need for having a technically competent building and construction ministry that can deal with this in the long term. For example, those 10 documents which were locked into legislation for earthquake-prone buildings in 2016-17, to a very large extent, they were done on an ad hoc basis and hurried. Well, again, as I've said before, it's buildings, structures, it's all of society and our economy. We've got something like, say, 2,800 structural engineers. Why can't we have 3% of them doing good work all the time, thinking about and sorting out these issues? I'm not saying that they don't listen to ordinary engineers making submissions, but what you have, this obsession in the DBH and MIMBY of policy, 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 but actually thinking about it from a true technical standard and feeding back to direct policy, in my opinion, is missing.
So Rod, based on those last few comments from John, how do you assess it? Have we got some deficiencies there?
Well, look, I was pretty heavily involved in Christchurch following the earthquakes there. Couple of visits there for a week at a time, particularly having a look at masonry buildings, because I had been on masonry standards and worked for a masonry company in my earlier days. I think what I found is that all the collapses and damage that you saw were all fairly predictable to engineers. Any half-pied, well-designed, well-proportioned building generally survived pretty well. One of the things John had mentioned earlier on was the tendency, or the vogue some years back, for having ductile buildings. Now, ductility is really just having something that can be deformed without breaking. And so you could have buildings that could be shaking and swaying quite significant amounts as long as they did not collapse. Now, lots of buildings designed that way have been so severely damaged that the structure stood up, but there's huge damage to the, you know, the buildings are basically a write-off. And I think we have learned the lesson, and I think we are no longer designing highly ductile buildings. But there's compromises. You can design a stiff building, but it's got a different response and attracting different earthquake loads.
Mm.
We're getting into fairly detailed technical issues.
Yeah, sure.
There.
Well, so based on we're going to have to wrap up, but and I know it's never enough. You guys are so obviously professionally involved in this structural engineering field that it makes us feel a bit inadequate even trying to shut you down and say we've been beaten by time. But any last comments from either of you to sort of wrap up and sort of see what we can do next? Oh, clearly we've got some issues at a government level or government department level. What else have we got to do?
Well, I think there's a society. I mean, it should be discussed. It's a referendum in the different areas where people decide what they want. But then again, it's a small risk. But do they want an old masonry church or museum to collapse on a busload of school children? We don't like collapsed buildings. And again, earthquake prone building is just little earthquakes, it's not big earthquakes. But for example, Don, you mentioned that your son-in-law was one of the last people getting out of Stadium Southam when it failed under a moderate snow load. Now, let's say that that collapse had occurred on an evening when Southern Steel were playing and there were 3,000 people in, and let's say 50 people were killed and a couple of hundred seriously injured. Well, we don't say, well, that's just a few weeks of road tolls, so we're not concerned about it. That would be a disaster. We actually don't like the collapses of buildings and things like that. And again, these things should have been discussed back in 2004, to discuss anymore. But I think we've just explained the issues involved. Anyone who's listening, just because a building is not earthquake prone doesn't mean it's safe. All it was trying to do was weed out the worst of the worst.
Okay, and I hope downtown Invercargill has weeded out the worst of the worst, because we've just spent, we didn't, but others have just spent a couple of hundred million building what is called Invercargill Central. It's a whole block of redevelopment. So welcome to come and have a look at that one day, you two gentlemen. Rod, any last comments from you?
Yes. excuse me. I think the real thing is managing public expectation and public education. The problem is that building design is not sexy, and people just accept there are buildings and they don't want to get involved in this sort of thing. But it is affecting all of us, and it is a risk, and it's a matter of how to manage it and the best way of tackling it. So I think public education is worthwhile.
Fantastic. Look, we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. It's clear we're just mere lay people when we talk about this, and we have two experts on. Great to have you on our show. There's a lot of people will have gotten something out of this discussion. Certainly I have. It's clearly been, I've been misinformed for a long, long time. So thank you for helping at least me get a little bit more of an understanding. And I'm sure, Jaspreet, you feel the same.
Absolutely. Definitely enlightened a wee bit, but there's a wee way to go. I have no doubt with these new standards coming in and more tightening, there'll be a whole lot more exposure to this stuff. But gentlemen, thank you so much for your time on Greenwash today.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
The new seismic hazard will double the loads on earthquake-prone buildings, so more of them will be earthquake-prone.
Oh, gosh. Brilliant. just something to look forward to, John.
That was the last save on John Scarry. Thanks,
thank
Rod,
you so
Rod,
much.
So we had Rod Fulford, John Scarry. Thanks, guys.
Goodbye.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.